Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th canto, chapter 22, entitled Prithu Maharaj's Meeting with the Kumaras, text number 16. Vyaktam matma vatam matma. Bhagavan atma bhavana. Svanam manugraha yemam. Siddharupi charatyaja. Vyaktam, clear. Atma vatam, of the transcendentalists. Atma, the goal of life. Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Atma bhavana, always wishing to elevate the living entities. Svanam, whose own devotees. Anugrahaya, just to show mercy. Imam, this way. Siddharupi, perfectly self-realized. Charati, travels. Ajaha, Narayan. Translation. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is always anxious to elevate the living entities who are His parts and parcels, and for their special benefit, the Lord travels all over the world in the form of self-realized persons like you. Purport. There are different kinds of transcendentalists, namely the jnanis or impersonalists, the mystic yogis, and of course, all the devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Kumaras, however, were both yogis and jnanis, and finally bhaktas later on. In the beginning, they were impersonalists, but later they developed devotional activities. Therefore, they are the best of the transcendentalists. The devotees are representatives of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and to elevate the conditioned souls to their original consciousness, they travel all over the universe to enlighten the conditioned souls about Krishna consciousness. The best devotees are Atmavat, or those who have fully realized the Supreme Soul. The Supreme Personality of Godhead as Paramatma is sitting within everyone's heart, trying to elevate everyone to the platform of Krishna consciousness. Therefore, he is called Atma Bhavana. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is always trying to give the individual soul the intelligence to understand about himself. He's always with the individual as a friend, sitting by the side of a friend, and he gives facilities to all living entities according to their desires. The word Atmavatam is significant in this verse. There are three different kinds of devotees, namely Kanista Adhikari, Majjhima Adhikari, and Uttama Adhikari. The neophyte, the preacher, and the Mahabhagavats, or the highly advanced devotee. The highly advanced devotee is one who knows the conclusion of the Vedas in full knowledge. Thus he becomes a devotee. Indeed, not only is he convinced himself, but he can convince others on the strength of Vedic evidence. The advanced devotee can also see all other living entities as part and parcel of the Supreme Lord without discrimination. The Madhyama Adhikari preacher is also well versed in the Shastras and can convince others also, but he discriminates between the favorable and the unfavorable. In other words, the Madhyama Adhikari does not care for the demoniac living entities, and the neophyte Kanista Adhikari does not know much about Shastra, but has full faith in the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Kumaras, however, were Mahabhagavats because after scrutinizingly studying the Absolute Truth, they became devotees. In other words, they were in full knowledge of the Vedic conclusion. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is confirmed by the Lord that there are many devotees, but a devotee who is fully conversant in the Vedic conclusion is very dear to him. Everyone is trying to elevate himself to the highest position according to his mentality. The karmis, who have a bodily concept of life, try to enjoy sense gratification to the utmost. The Jnani's idea of the highest position is merging into the effulgence of the Lord. But a devotee's highest position is in preaching all over the world the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, the devotees are actually the representatives of the Supreme Lord, and as such, they travel all over the world directly as Narayan, because they carry Narayan within their hearts and preach his glories. The representative of Narayan is as good as Narayan, but he is not to conclude, like the Mayavadis, that he has become Narayan. Generally, a sannyasi is addressed as Narayan by the Mayavadis. Their idea is that simply by taking sannyas, one becomes equal to Narayan, or becomes Narayan himself. The Vaishnava conclusion is different, as stated by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Saksattaritvene samasta sastrir, uktastata bhavyate eva sadvi, kintu pravor yapriya eva tasya, vandei guru sri charanaravindam. According to the Vaishnava philosophy, a devotee is as good as Narayan not by becoming Narayan, but by becoming the most confidential servant of Narayan. Such great personalities act as spiritual masters for the benefit of the people in general, and as such, a spiritual master who's preaching the glories of Narayan should be accepted as Narayan and be given all respects due to him. Om Agyanatimirandasya Ganandana Salakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Nama Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhuttale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapanantikam Vandiyam Siguru Siyutapada Kamalam Sigurun Vaisnavam Stya Sirupam Sagrajatam Sagana Ranganatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvetam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sagana Lalita Sivisakam Vitam Stya He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesa Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneswari Vishabhanu Sutta Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanshakalpa Tarubhyacha Sakripa Sanduvyevacha Padidanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Nama Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasudhi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Lord Krishna is eternally engaged in his transcendental pleasure pastimes along with the eternal liberated devotees, which are most of the living beings. It is said that about 10% of the living beings is residing in the material world, right? And then 90% is engaged in the spiritual sky. Such statements of percentages are sometimes a little bewildering, because when we think of percentages, then we think, well, then there's a limit, right, to the living entities in the material world and in the spiritual world. So how is then, is it possible that this will eternally go on? At one day, one point in time, it should stop, the cycle of living entities coming from the spiritual world to the material world, because once one returns to the spiritual world, one never comes back. Naitimam eti surajuna. But then again, we see descriptions that the living entities are unlimited in number, even in the material world. What to speak of the spiritual world? So this is clearly in the realm of achintya, beyond what is to be captured by the logic of the living being. To some extent, this achintya element remains, even for the topmost devotee. Even the Mahabhagavat does not know everything and anything. Right? Even the Prema Bhakta is not necessarily fully knowing every detail about Krishna, because one cannot know every detail about Krishna. Krishna doesn't even know every detail about himself, right? That is mentioned in the Nectar of Devotion, that there's a competition between the knowledge of Krishna and the qualities of Krishna. And that Krishna's knowledge is unlimited, but then he finds that there are qualities which were not included in that unlimited knowledge. And when he gets to know more about those qualities, right, as well, and his unlimited knowledge is growing, then only he find that there are more unlimited qualities that he still did not know about. And again, his knowledge is growing, and this is an eternal thing. So what to speak of the jiva, the living entity? The living entity can never know the Supreme Lord in full. Therefore, atintakalu ye bhava natamstakini yo jayet. It is not possible to fully know the Supreme Lord. Yet, it is stated that the Mahabhagavat devotees are in full knowledge of the Supreme Lord. It means that the Mahabhagavat is in full knowledge of the position of the Supreme Lord, and that he fully understands the nature of the Supreme Lord as the Supreme Controller. Maya jakshena prakriti suyate sacharacharam, that nothing happens without the will of the Lord. That he also understands the Supreme Lord as dayalu, Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu daya karamar, toma bina ke dayalu. Other than Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the most merciful, Mahavananyaya, the most merciful personality. So the pure devotee understands particularly the mercy of the Supreme Lord. Srila Krishnadas Kaviraj is also pointing out that we should focus our intelligence upon understanding the mercy of the Supreme Lord. That is the essence. If one is indeed interested, he says, in logic and argument, then apply that logic and argument in understanding the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Because the mercy of the Lord, that is the essential quality of the Lord, naturally, because we are always dependent on the mercy of the Lord in all conditions of life. Whether we are in the hellish planets, or whether we are here in the middle planetary systems, or whether we are in the liberated stage, or whether we are in the spiritual world, we are always dependent on the mercy of the Lord. Some time ago, we did a study on the topic of mercy, and saw that different Sanskrit words are sometimes used for mercy. It is said the word daya, in particular, meaning mercy, is referring to the generous mercy which is being bestowed upon everyone and anyone without them having done anything to solicit it. So daya particularly is that mercy which is given unasked for to anyone. Kripa may also mean that, but kripa sometimes also means the mercy that is coming in reciprocation for a particular type of surrender that has been given. Then we see that in the 10th canto, there was a description of the associates of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and how they were all receiving the mercy, the associates of Krishna. Sorry, in the 10th canto, the associates of Krishna in Vrindavan. And it is described there how they are all getting the mercy of the Lord, and this time the term prasad was being used. Right? We see that in the 10th canto, mostly the word prasad is used for mercy. That even the liberated devotee, who is not requiring mercy to be delivered from suffering, because he is not suffering, right? Even the liberated devotee, who is always absorbed in transcendental bliss, still is totally dependent on the prasad of the Lord, right? He lives on prasad, right? Without prasad, there is no question of maintaining one's existence. Just as it is explained in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that Lord Chaitanya is known as Vishvambar, or he who maintains the entire universe. And Lord Chaitanya said, or Lord Krishna actually said, that it is time that I will appear in this world and will give love of God to everyone and anyone. Otherwise, how can I rightly be called the maintainer? Right? I'm not truly the maintainer of anyone unless I give that person love of God. So love of God is never a static experience. Before I was a devotee, I was interested in spiritual life, but for a long time I had no faith in any particular group that was practicing. I had seen so many so-called yogis or spiritualists, and it seemed all somewhat awkward. I had gone to India, and I had visited some of the Babas sitting at the Ganges in Benares, but they were always very eager to ask for some money. And, you know, I had some money, so I said, okay, you want some money? Here, take $100. Right? Okay. Now you're happy. Right? Yeah, so I gave him. And then, so I was talking with this particular Baba there every day, and he was sitting at the side of the Ganges. And then, because I'd given him a donation, and a fat one, right, the next day he thought, like, well, let me give him some special experience. So he invited me for a special session with some local sadhus. And what were they doing? They were bringing out the chilm, right? The chilm to smoke the ganja. And I was thinking, like, look, you know, I didn't come all the way to India for this, you know. That I can get in Amsterdam, right, on every street corner. I mean, give me a break, you know. I mean, before I was a devotee, I used to live in this alley, and next door there was a dealer, and he would regularly throw the things over the wall when the police would come, right, into our garden, kilos of it. So it was a difficult time. Three houses away, they had the cocaine, and on the other end of the street, there was the heroin, and everybody knew that, you know. And that was just another street in Amsterdam, what can I say? Nothing special. So I didn't come to India for that. I came to India to be free from all these things and to just... So it was a little disappointing. So I did not develop much faith in these Babas, I must say. I continued my travels, and I came back, and I saw one teacher of Hatha Yoga who was also teaching a South Indian philosophy, but he was particularly in a youth center called Zero. I became part of that youth center because there was a vegetarian restaurant, and in India I had become a vegetarian. So I went there, and he was really good in yoga asanas, fantastic. And he was also really sharp in his South Indian philosophy, but he was also really interested in the female students a lot more than the male ones. So, again, it wasn't very convincing to me. Right? I wasn't like thinking that, he was really very high. Then I went to a session there. This center called Zero was a New Age center. And they had like a vegetarian restaurant, and I cooked in the restaurant sometimes, and for that I could eat for free, and I could for free take part in all the courses, anything they had, so sounded good deal. And I even could live in a macrobiotic commune, and I didn't have to pay any money. The only thing was I was not allowed to eat cheese, which is like pretty heavy for somebody from Holland and Switzerland. Like, it's almost like a death sentence, right? Anyway, you know, smuggle a piece of cheese under the coat, bring it in the house, lock the door. You know, that wasn't so bad. As a price to pay to live in that house, right? We managed to get our quota of cheese so that we could survive. So I was there in that restaurant, and then one day I was able to partake in one of the free courses, and it was bioenergetics. So this bioenergetics was a system of going to your roots, right? Going deep inside yourself and getting in touch with your real feelings that you had suppressed for so long, and now you could go deep inside and connect with them and finally express them, and then express all the pain and agony in a scream, and in the ultimate sense, like the advanced students of bioenergetics, they would be able to reach the level of the primordial scream, right? The original scream, the Urschrei, we could say, right? That which comes from the toes of your existence and where you would liberate yourself from all contamination. Wow! Right, what an advertisement, right? So I thought, okay, let's check it out. So I went there, and there was one lady, she was teaching the thing, and there we were. And at one point, there was a session where everyone had to stand up, and you had to put your feet towards the toes, pointing towards each other as much as possible, right? So, like that, you know. So, you know, you bend your feet inwards, like, as much as possible, right? Stand like that. So it was a bit painful, quite uncomfortable, right, to say the least. And then she said, and now bend your knees. Now you try that, you know. You try stand like that and bend your knees, right? It's impossible. So all these people are trying to bend their knees. And, you know, you see all these faces. And she goes like, painful, isn't it? Right? She says, painful, isn't it? And everybody says, yes. And she says, all right, now express that pain, right? Express it, right? Oh, God, that's where I walked out, you know. God, I got another pain. I got sick in the stomach, right? I couldn't handle that. So I saw so many things. I've been in sessions where people were sitting back to back, touching each other's back, and feeling each other's back, communicating through the back, you know, and really like, you know, feeling like the other spirit soul, right? And letting the vibrations flow and all that. I tried it all. And in that session, the most exciting thing was there were 20 people. You'd have to lie on your back. And there were 20 people who would put their hands on top of you, just like that, while you're lying down. And, well, that's heavy. It feels quite heavy. If 20 people put their hands on you, it feels like there's an elephant on top of you. Yeah? It's a quite an intense experience. And then, on one signal, these 20 people would suddenly have to put their hands under the person and lift him up, you know. And this was supposed to be some sort of Kundalini experience, right? Wow! You know. So, people were all buying into these cheap effects, you know, and I was thinking, like, what's spiritual about all this? This is bogus. So for a long time, I retreated on my own turf and practiced my own homemade spiritual life. Not so much because I wanted so much to practice my own homemade spiritual life, but I couldn't see anything out there which was really worth following. The church, definitely not, right? I had serious doubts about that institution and about the leaders of it. Nor did I find it in the yogis of India, nor did I find it anywhere. But then the years went by, and with my own homemade process, I also didn't get that far, right? I was playing guitar and singing my songs, and within the music I was trying to go in a path of purification, right? Music as a means of self-purification. This was the process. Right? And so I was singing about purity and authenticity and all these things in front of people, trying to bring everyone to another level of consciousness. But it didn't work, right? People came and said, oh, your music is great, but I could see they're totally materialistic. What's the benefit of my music if the materialists like it? We see that, you know. You see some musician, he puts his soul into the music, right? And then they play that music in the supermarket,
Yeah? The musician puts his soul in the music and he's totally turning away from the world and he's like trying to give different vibrations. And they use that very same music that he makes with all those feelings in the supermarket to enhance people in the materialistic buying spirit. Right? So I felt disgusted with this whole music also. I felt, I'm not getting anywhere. And I said, I don't have any shakti, I don't have any power, because I lack purity. I knew it. So, for a moment, there was some little truth dawning, and I thought, maybe I need someone to teach me. So I decided, next time I go to India, I'm going to visit all kinds of different ashrams. And in the process, I also wound up with the Tibetan Buddhists, right? And there I was in the village of the Dalai Lama, and I went to the temple where the Tibetans sit all afternoon in front of a big statue of Buddha, chanting mantras which sound something like the whole hours and hours like that. I listened to it for quite some time, that's why I still remember it today. And in the center of the town, they had prayer mills, right? These cylindrical things, metal forms, round cylinders sitting on an axle that spin around, right? Clockwise, and people push them. And if they make one circle, that's a prayer, right? Some prayer is written on them and they have to make a circle. And people keep these things spinning all the time. They push them. And there was a whole battery of them. 10 on one side, 10 on the other side. And people would come and they would push them. So, you know, this is interesting. Right? When you come from the West as a tourist, you think like, well, this is something else. Right? So there were benches also. So I would sit there on the benches and watch the people especially. It's a hobby of mine to watch people. I still do it, you know. I stare at people to the point where they say, you want something? Right? 'Cause I like that, studying people, you know. So I was sitting there watching the people pushing these prayer mills. And, well, all kinds of people were there. Tibetans, foreigners, and also lamas, you know. So, of course, the lamas were the most interesting, right? So, watching the lamas, you know. And there's this old lama, he's coming by, and he's pushing the prayer mills. And I had seen him now for a few days. I'd been there for a few days, every day, sitting there for a while. And I'd seen him already before. So, on the second or third day, whatever it was, I thought, well, let me greet him, you know. By now, we've seen each other so many times, right? So, I go like, you know, something like, hello? Hello? Right? Hello? Not a response. Nothing. Not a twitch in his face. Nothing. Not a word over it, from his lips. But he was walking around with this heavenly smile on his face. So, I was thinking, well, he's old, you know. Maybe he's deaf, right? Maybe he didn't hear. So the second time he came around, you know, I tried again. Hello! But still nothing, no response, you know. So it was very awkward and I felt very weird, you know. I felt strange. Now, before I went to India, someone had given me a book called the Bhagavad Gita as it is, which I had in my bag. So, as I was sitting there and still thinking, that was a strange experience with that lama. That was really weird. I opened up the Bhagavad Gita, and it just happened to open up on a page describing impersonalists. And it was describing the description, how the happiness of the impersonalist is like the water in the hoof print of a calf compared to the happiness of a devotee, which is like the unlimited ocean. And Srila Prabhupada elaborated on that point and began to describe that the happiness of the impersonalist is fixed, it is static. Right? He reaches his level and that's it. There he is, Brahmanda. I've got it, you know, yes, ah. He has the bliss. Watch out there. I'll confiscate the film if you go on like this. The KGB will come. Yes. They always try to catch me when I make funny faces. I don't know what that is. Can't you take a picture when I make a saintly face like that? So anyway, the impersonalist, his happiness is fixed. Once he has it, once he's reached that state of Brahman, that's it. There's nothing beyond attained, right? He's got it, you know? Okay, got it. Yeah. But the happiness of a devotee is never fixed. It is eternally growing. It is eternally growing. So as I was reading that, right there and then, it struck me. And that was the point which turned around the whole, my whole life, because at that point I decided, this is it. This is it. Right? It must be the truth, because how can the smaller concept be true? The bigger concept, the unlimited growing happiness, is a bigger concept. It must be the truth. Right? So I was philosophically convinced. So then I said, well, then it must be Krishna. So now I knew, you know, that 3 kilometers up the mountain from this Tibetan village, there was a temple where there was a picture of Krishna. So I thought, all right, then let me go there and offer a flower, because it says in the Gita one should offer a flower. Yeah, flower. So, okay, I said, I'll go offer a flower. So I got a nice flower, and then I thought, I may as well then chant Hare Krishna on the way. And I was singing the Maha Mantra quite loud, and everyone could hear. I was walking in the street, you know, with my flower. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. And people must have thought that I was cracked, but I didn't care, because anyway, I was 10,000 kilometers away from home, so what do you care, you know? I didn't care at all. But just then, one boy from my hometown came walking around the corner, and he was looking at me like, what are you doing? Right? I thought, oh no. Now everybody knows. Anyway, too late then, right? So well, it's too late now. I may as well go on then. So I went on and offered my flower. And after that, later I went to the temple in Vrindavan. Anyway, so Krishna consciousness is not just a sentimental process. Krishna consciousness is not meant to be like that. Of course, many people have joined because of the halva, right? You know, the Sunday feast, the halva was just too good, right? Too good. The other day, when we were chanting on the lake, there was that little boy. Who was coming back 3 times for halva. His mother wasn't watching. The first time he came, and he took a little bit to taste. Okay. And then he wanted another piece, and he tasted again. And then he wanted the whole cup. He ate that. And then he came back 5 minutes later, he wanted another cup. And he came again, and another cup. That's a good sign. Very good sign. And his mother wasn't seeing anything. He was eating ridiculous quantities of halva, but running into the bushes and eating it there. So his mother didn't notice. She thought he was innocently playing. Little did she know that with every bite, right, he was turning into a Hare Krishna. She wouldn't have been so peaceful there, right? She would have been totally alarmed, right? But too late now, right? She won't know. But after so many years, you know, when this boy joins, know what it was, the halva. Right? So don't underestimate halva. Halva has made many devotees, without a doubt. Right? Without a doubt. It is a very powerful means. But still, one cannot live on halva alone. Right? That doesn't work. We cannot just go on and on relishing the halva and expect that that will do us for a lifetime. After some time, even halva doesn't satisfy anymore. Right? One wants something. Of course, you know, we still don't mind a little halva. Beyond that, there is a need for transcendental knowledge. Without true knowledge about the nature of the Supreme Lord and how he manifests himself in all his energies and what the purpose is of all that. Without that, one cannot truly remain fixed in Krishna consciousness. Sometimes we find in Srimad Bhagavatam these lengthy descriptions about the universal form. Right? It's just like really like, you know, gets very dry and technical, or descriptions how from one element another element is manifesting, or descriptions about certain types of yoga, or, you know, you get some description of the universe and how all the planets are in their orbits, and that so many yojanas this one, so many yojanas that one. Or you get in the ninth canto, you get these dynasties, right? These endless dynasties, and this one was the son of that one, and that one was the son of this one, and he had three sons, and he had four, and then they had a daughter, and they also, and you think, my God, you know, oh God, can I skip this portion? Right? The temptation is there. Can I go to the next chapter, maybe? Right? These portions seem so dry. But if we see them all within the context of the mercy of Krishna, then it's very important to understand how, in so many ways, the mercy of Krishna is filtering down. That's the reason why we are seeing all these descriptions about the way the material elements come about, how the material energy works, the material dynasties, because within these dynasties, the Supreme Lord appears. And that's amazing. And the whole dynasty is blessed just because the Lord appears. So what was it? The question may be asked, what was it that the Lord appeared in these particular dynasties? Which were the qualities of such dynasties? Suddenly the dynasties become interesting because the Lord appeared. And suddenly it's interesting to understand what kind of personalities there were in these dynasties. Like that, if we see how all these descriptions in Srimad Bhagavatam are simply describing how the mercy of the Lord works, then we, and all along, we see that the motive of the Lord in making all these arrangements is only one. The motive that the Lord is Atma Bhavana, always wishing to elevate the living entities. Is Atma Bhavana. He's always desiring to elevate the living entities from their suffering condition. And not only is he eager to elevate the living entities from a suffering condition, but even in the spiritual world, he's always eager to elevate the living entities. Even those residents in the spiritual world, Krishna expands himself and gives personal attention to every single living being. One scripture which is very interesting is the Brihad Bhagavatamrita of Srila Sanatana Goswami. Now, part two has just come out. The BBT has just published two parts, right? But they will publish it in three parts, so there's still one part to come. And these books are absolutely essential. It is not just some sort of, shall I get it or shall I not, right? Shall I read it or shall I not read it? No. These books are containing essential Siddhanta, right? It's not just nice stories, but there is very interesting Siddhanta. For example, in Brihad Bhagavatamrita Part 1, there is a description of Vaikuntha, and we find a description how the residents of Vaikuntha do not just have bodies with four arms, just like Lord Vishnu, but simultaneously they also have other bodies, and they use these other bodies for the pleasure of the Lord. So sometimes they take the form of animals, sometimes they take the form of sages, sometimes they take a whole variety of forms for the pleasure of the Lord. So in this way, the Vaikuntha pastimes are being enhanced by those four-armed devotees who have the same form as the Lord, but simultaneously have other forms as well. We never heard that before, but there it is. Very authorized, Sanatan Goswami himself makes such a statement. So this is essential information, not just what you call a little frill, not just a little detail. No, this is core information. So another very interesting point in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita is the description of Gopakumar, right? Gopakumar, who is a cowherd boy and who is looking for the topmost place, and who comes in Vaikuntha eventually, after having been already in the heavenly planets, he comes in Vaikuntha and finds that he's not satisfied there, because by nature it's not his natural place. Right? Finally, then, Gopakumar returns to Golok, which is his natural place, and there he basically goes back to Godhead. So it's very interesting, because usually the scriptures, they stop, right? It says, I mean, all the stories about the great personalities, they usually end at that point. And he went back to Godhead, right? And the demigods showered flowers, like Prithu Maharaj, later will go back to Godhead in a plane, right? In a Vaikuntha Pushpa Vimana, he will go up in the sky and he'll fly past the demigods, and his wife will follow him in another plane, right? And they'll both fly up beyond the heavenly planets up to the spiritual sky, and then they disappear out of sight, and they went back to the spiritual sky. And the demigods, they were blowing their bugles and playing their drums, etc., and that was it, right? So generally speaking, it stops there. But in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, there's the description of Swarup, of who was Gopakumar, now he is Swarup. He's returning back to the spiritual world. He's coming back after having been away from a long time. So how does it work? It's very interesting. Is he just back? Plop. You know, he was gone and suddenly, whoop, he manifests again in the middle of all the cowherd boys, right? And it's just like part of the game again. Is that how it went? Right? How does it go? No, it is described that he came to Vrindavan, and when he was in Vrindavan, he saw that all the people were very absent-minded. And he said, what's going on here? And nobody was giving any response. No one. He said, excuse me, which country is this? Who is the king? No reply, no response. Anyway, it's a strange place. The people are so absent-minded. And he kept on walking, and he saw a palace, a beautiful palace. And he says, who is the ruler of this palace? And one elder lady said, this is the palace of Nanda Maharaj. He is the king of the cowherds, yes, here in Gokul. He is the Lord and Master. And she said, here, this is the residence of Krishna, the son of Nanda, right? And he has now gone to the forest. And you can see how everyone is looking in the direction of the forest where he went. Even the trees are looking in that direction. Right? So everyone was looking in one particular direction. The trees were pointing in one direction. All of Vrindavan was looking in that one direction where Krishna went, waiting for him to return. So finally, Krishna, Swarup is there with everyone else, looking in that direction, waiting for Krishna to return. Then Krishna returns. And as Krishna returns, Krishna says, Swarup! Swarup, where have you been? I haven't seen you for such a long time. Right? It's so wonderful to see you. And Swarup is equally overwhelmed to see Krishna, and they come up, and Swarup embraces Krishna, and Krishna becomes so overwhelmed by ecstasy that he crashes on the ground and falls unconscious. And the gopi says, who is this intruder? What has he done? He must be an agent of Kamsa. What's he doing? Like, making Krishna faint like that. You know, who is he? You know, some demon? Right? Right? So the gopis are like ready to take action. But Balaram is there and says, no, it's all right. Actually, Swarup is a very dear friend of Krishna. And Krishna is just overwhelmed by the emotions. Swarup, please chant in Krishna's ear. And as Swarup is chanting in Krishna's ear, Krishna again regains consciousness. Meanwhile, Mother Yasoda comes out of the house and said, Nanda Maharaj is already waiting for you to come and take prasadam. Please come, don't keep him waiting now. Please come, very urgently. So, Krishna is going, and he says to Swarup, come, come. So Krishna and Balaram and Swarup sit down with Nanda Maharaj to take prasadam. And in this way it is described, and then the pastimes continue and continue and continue, and Swarup is just part of it. And the next day he's asked by Mother Yasoda to help Krishna in taking his bath. Because when Krishna takes his bath, everyone is helping. It's not that he's taking a shower all alone, no. All the residents are helping, everyone. There's a whole bunch of people involved. One carries the bathing water, another one undresses Krishna, and he just sits there, takes off the ornaments, someone pours the water, etc. All this is going on, just like as we are worshipping the deity with so many pujaris. And Swarup is involved in assisting like that. He's back. So it's very nice, that description in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. And not only very nice, it also kind of really shows how it works, and how Krishna is personally very, very much involved with every living entity. It's not just that he's back and Krishna doesn't notice it. No, Krishna is noticing it so much that he fell in ecstasy on the ground. That's how much Krishna is concerned with every living being. So it is explained by Sanatana Goswami, which is like showing the nature of how much the Lord is concerned with every living being and is always anxious to elevate every living being. And this goes on eternally, even in the spiritual world, by the constant association and interaction, by sometimes being present before me and sometimes making me brokenhearted by not being present before me, as Lord Chaitanya chants in the Sikshastika. This is how the Lord is churning the love of God to a point that it is eternally increasing. Okay, with that I'll end. Now, any questions or comments? That's Achincha again. No. What to do? Cannot know everything. Yeah. Wasn't mentioned. Must be the Maha Mantra. What else? But it's not stated. I can only guess. But there's a chance, good chance, was the Maha Mantra. Okay, then we'll end like with this. So in this way, it's very important to see the Bhagavatam in the context of the mercy of the Lord. And if we look at it like that, at how all these descriptions are actually describing how the mercy of the Lord is manifest, then we are able to fulfill the injunction of Krishna's Kaviraj Goswami, who told us that we should apply our intelligence in understanding the mercy of the Lord. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.